Welcome back. Earlier in the course, we traced the impact made first by the Etruscans and later by the Greeks on Roman religion. We saw that in the year 217, the Romans officially abolished all distinction between Greek and Roman gods. We saw, too, how many new cults, such as that of the Magna Mater, the Great Mother, entered the Roman pantheon just before the end of the Second Punic War in 201 BC. This was not, however, the end of history, so to speak. The Roman pantheon had by no means reached final definition. Being a polytheistic pantheon, it never would, and there were plenty of new developments in the centuries to come, quite aside from the emergence and ultimate triumph of Christianity. In this lecture, we're going to take the story down into the early imperial era, and that takes us, of course, into the Christian period, and I'll have something to say about Christianity at the end, though this will also be the subject of a separate lecture. One thing to note at the beginning, just as the Romans refrained from imposing Latin on their subjects, so they refrained from imposing their religious system on the peoples they conquered. The one exception to that rule is ruler cult, which did indeed become a means by which the Romans demonstrated their power, and to which most of their subjects, the Jews were an exception, were required to pay at least lip service. It may seem from what we've learned so far that the Romans were extremely open to innovative beliefs and practices, and that they were prepared to make infinite concessions and adjustments to their own religious system accordingly. Well, if that was true at all, it only held good up to the end of the Second Punic War. The Second Punic War had brought Rome to within a hair's breadth of defeat. She wouldn't face a threat of the same magnitude ever again, at least not until the beginning of the barbarian incursions in the 3rd century AD, though she did face attack from the Gauls in the final decade of the 1st century BC. But the Gauls, terrifying as they were, never posed a threat to Rome itself. So, from 201 onwards, the Romans didn't any longer need the support of other peoples and weren't dependent on the goodwill of their gods. There was another development. The Romans became suspicious of the use to which worship itself could be put. They saw it as potentially serving a kind of nationalistic agenda. Today, we're all too familiar with the fact that religion and politics are often intimately related. The Romans seem to have made this discovery overnight in the early 2nd century BC, precisely around the time, incidentally, when they were beginning to abandon the velvet glove approach for the iron fist in their dealings with the Greeks. In particular, they seem to have become deeply suspicious of the intentions of Greeks living in the Italian peninsula. The chief evidence for this has to do with the Bacchanalia. These were secret rites celebrated in honor of Dionysus, otherwise known as Bacchus, the god of wine, intoxication, ecstasy, drama, and liberation. Dionysus is perhaps best known today for his characterization in Euripides' Bacchae. In fact, the Bacchae is so named for his female worshippers who have followed him from the east to Thebes in central Greece in order to win adherents. In the course of the play, he induces the Theban women to murder their king Pentheus because he has opposed the introduction of his worship. They actually murder the king by tearing him limb from limb and then eating his raw flesh in a state of ecstasy. Euripides offers a frightening portrait of the effects of mass hysteria placed in the service or disservice of religion. But just as in his Hippolytus, which we discussed in the lecture on sex and sexuality, he refrains from passing judgment. He does not condemn Dionysus. How can you condemn a god? The Bacchanalia began to spread from Magna Graecia northwards in the early 2nd century BC. The rites reached Rome in 186 BC. By this point, there was, as we've seen, a large number of Greeks living in the city, most of them slaves. Everything about these rites made Romans' hackles rise. In fact, the response of the Romans was not dissimilar to that of Pentheus, in that they, like the Theban king, judged the worship of Dionysus to be a cloak for a conspiracy aimed at challenging the authority of the Roman state. Indeed, they saw it as a threat to the very structure of Roman society, and for a number of reasons. First, because the rites were conducted in secret, and only those who had undergone initiation were permitted to participate in them. Second, because they appealed especially to the lowest strata of society, including slaves. And third, because the rites were orgiastic in nature, which meant that they produced a temporary loss of social responsibility, the kind of state of consciousness that comes from partaking of intoxicating substances, though there's no actual evidence that Dionysus's worshippers actually indulged in alcohol or drugs. Their state of mind seems to have been induced solely by religious intoxication. The historian Livy, who is extremely hostile to the Bacchanalia, even though he is living nearly two centuries later, describes it as a pestilential evil. He tells us that the celebrants indulged in sexual debauchery and committed acts of murder. He even goes so far as to claim that the reason why drums and cymbals accompanied the rites was to drown out the cries of the victims. Well, why exactly did the Romans become so paranoid? The main reason, as I mentioned earlier, is that they suspected that the Bacchanalia was fomenting a sense of Greek ethnicity that challenged Rome's dominance of Italy. It is, after all, natural for foreigners to wish to associate together and to celebrate their own identity. Clubs, as we saw in the lecture on leisure and entertainment, also performed this function in the classical world. But Bacchism confronted the Romans with something different, a mass movement. And it offered an alternative to conventional state-sponsored religion. It had its own cells, its own rituals, its own officials, and its own rules. The Senate treated it as a conjuratio. The word means literally a swearing together, i.e. something close to conspiracy. Accordingly, it passed a decree banning the celebration of the Bacchanalia throughout Italy. It became illegal to conduct the rites unless you made application to the authorities. And even then, only five worshippers could participate at any one time. And the penalty for evading these restrictions was death. A witch hunt ensued, both in Rome and throughout the peninsula, and a reward was offered to anyone who revealed the names of those who were implicated in the so-called conspiracy. Livy tells us that more than 7,000 men and women were involved in the rites, and of those who were apprehended, most were put to death, others were thrown into prison. Cult sites were destroyed, and a perpetual ban was imposed on Bacchic rites. The Romans didn't destroy cult sites that had been established before the entry of this new kind of Bacchic worship, so it's unlikely that Bacchism died out altogether. Well, were there really any solid grounds to the Romans' suspicions? We just don't know. What is clear, however, is the degree of bad faith that existed between the Romans and the Greeks at this date, just a decade after Flamininus's declaration of independence for Greeks on the mainland. Incidentally, Rome's reaction to the Bacchanalia anticipates in many ways her reaction to both Judaism and Christianity. I'll be devoting a whole lecture later in the course, first to the interaction between Jews, Greeks, and Romans, and second to Christianity's debt to Greece and Rome. So I won't say much about that now, though it's appropriate to note that Rome's dealings with the Jews in the first century AD in some ways replicates her response to the Bacchanalia in the second century BC. Another group who fell foul of the Roman authorities for challenging the traditional Roman view of the gods were the Epicureans. Epicureans claimed that the gods existed but were not interested in human affairs, and this meant that it was pointless to try to win their favour. Again, I'll be talking about Epicurean philosophy later. It was a very important philosophical movement that eventually won many adherents in Rome. In 173 and then again in 161 BC, the Senate expelled Epicurean philosophers for undermining, as they saw it, traditional religious observance. And this same attitude of suspicion towards un-Roman gods and perspectives was still very much current in the first century BC. A notable victim was Isis, the goddess of a thousand names. She was an Egyptian whose cult spread throughout the Greek-speaking world and who, as a result, became thoroughly Hellenized in her form. She particularly appealed to women and was their guardian deity in childbirth. The history of her supporters' attempts to establish her cult tells us a great deal about the connection between politics and religion in antiquity. Like Bacchism, Isis threatened the Roman authorities because her devotees had to undergo initiation. In fact, they made repeated attempts to establish a temple to her in Rome, which the authorities repeatedly opposed. Then, in the late 40s, the decision was taken to permit the construction of a temple jointly to Isis and Serapis. Serapis was the Greek form of Osiris Apis, a manifestation of the Egyptian god Osiris in the form of a sacred bull called Apis. When the Egyptians backed the wrong side in the showdown between Octavian and Mark Antony in 31 BC, the project, however, was called off. And in fact, Octavian forbade the worship of Egyptian gods anywhere within the Pomerium, that's to say, anywhere within the city of Rome. It wasn't until the reign of Caligula that Isis was officially recognized and incorporated into the Roman pantheon. And that was partly because Caligula greatly admired Egyptian culture. He even went so far as to sleep with his sister, thereby emulating the ancient Egyptian practice of brother-sister marriage. Isis's cult grew and grew in popularity, and she figures prominently in Apuleius's novel, The Golden Ass, written around the middle of the 2nd century AD, where she is invoked thus: "Holy and eternal protector of all mankind, you who are always beneficent in nourishing mortals, providing the sweet love of a mother to those who are distressed by afflictions." Up till now, we've been proceeding chronologically, and I now want to focus specifically on the Augustan Principate, a period which introduced a package of reforms of a religious nature intended A, to reinvigorate Roman religion, and B, to help solidify Augustus's own role at the center of Roman religion itself. This process came about, however, more as a result of internal pressure than from influence abroad. First, however, a bit of background. The Principate was established in 27 BC after a period of prolonged civil war lasting over half a century. First, there had been civil war involving Sulla, then civil war between Pompey and Caesar, and finally civil war between Octavian and Mark Antony. Religious observance in that period was neglected, and temples fell into ruin. The Augustan poet Horace, in one of his most famous odes, writes, "Even if you are guiltless, you will pay, Roman, for the crimes of your ancestors. Until you reconstruct the temples and the crumbling edifices of the gods and their statues that have become soiled with black smoke. The reason you have the right to rule is because you make yourself lower than the gods. This is the be-all and end-all of all things. The neglected gods have given many evils to sorrowing Italy. Twice already have the Parthian kings crushed the assaults that we undertook without consulting the gods." We don't know exactly when Horace wrote this poem, but it was probably sometime around 27 BC. He's claiming that the Romans suffered defeat at the hands of the Parthians because of their neglect of the gods. Rome actually sustained three defeats at the hands of the Parthians, though he only mentions two, one in 53 BC, one in 40, and one in 36. He's probably just thinking of the two most recent defeats. The poem is particularly interesting because it suggests that the gods punish human wickedness, a rare sentiment in either Greek or Roman religion. We don't, of course, know whether Augustus himself believed that this was the reason why the Romans were beaten. What we do know is that he thought it made good political sense to evoke the memory of Rome's defeats as a justification for revitalizing Roman religion. In the Res Gestae, the account of his achievements that he only promulgated after his death, he claims that he restored, re feci is the Latin verb, 82 temples of the gods in the city on the authority of the Senate, not omitting, he says, any that needed to be restored at that time. 82 temples. That gives us not only a very vivid picture of the physical decay of Rome when Augustus became princeps, but also of the scale of urban renewal that Rome underwent under his direction. He also revived ancient ceremonies which had lapsed and took other steps to reinvigorate Roman religion. And he introduced new cults. I mentioned in the earlier lecture on religion that it is at times of social and political change that new cults often get introduced. As I've argued in my book entitled Introducing New Gods, new cults help to make the social and political readjustments acceptable to the population in general. Augustus did this first by establishing a new cult of his adoptive deified father, Divus Iulius. On January the 1st, 42 BC, rather less than 2 years after Julius Caesar's assassination, the Senate consecrated him as a god. One of the things that justified the cult of Divus Iulius in the popular mind was the fact that when Octavian, as he still was then, held games in honor of Venus Genetrix, Venus the mother, a few months after the assassination, a comet made its appearance in the sky just when the spectators were leaving the amphitheater. As Pliny the Elder tells us, quoting from Augustus's lost autobiography, the plebs interpreted this as signifying, I quote, that the anima or soul of Caesar had been received among the immortal gods. The technical term for the belief that the dead have been transformed into stars is catasterism, derived directly from the Greek. It was a very old Greek belief. The constellation of Castor and Pollux, the heavenly twins, are one such example of a starry transformation. Anyhow, the fact that Julius Caesar had become Divus meant that Octavian could now officially call himself Divi Filius, son of the deified, although he didn't claim any divine status himself. Julius Caesar's award of divine status was facilitated by the fact that the Greek practice of ruler cult was by this point entirely familiar to the Romans. I'll have more to say about ruler cult in a moment. Then, in 2 BC, Augustus used religion to advance his cause by introducing another new cult, that of Mars Ultor, Mars the Avenger, in recognition of the assistance he had received from the god. He did so in fulfillment of a vow that he had taken exactly 40 years earlier, before the Battle of Philippi, to erect a temple to the war god Mars once he had succeeded in taking revenge on all of Caesar's assassins. But the cult also enabled him to promote the concept of the principate, because the victory at Philippi had set him on the path towards becoming Augustus. Let's turn next to what was going on in the Greek-speaking world. As we see from Pausanias' description of Greece, which was written in the 2nd century AD, not a lot had changed since the 5th century BC. Largely, the Greeks were still worshipping their traditional gods. It's true they were also worshipping foreign gods. I've mentioned Isis and Serapis, and another was Zeus Sabazius. But these were already established in the Greek-speaking world as early as the late 5th century BC. The homegrown gods, however, had failed them, we might say, at least on the field of battle, and it's difficult to envisage how the Greeks might have injected the same energy into the performance of cult, given that they were now subjugated to Rome. That's not to say that they ceased to believe in their gods. They were still important, but their gods did not stride the big stage any longer as they had done once. So one response to this circumstance was religious revivalism. A particularly interesting example is the case of the Spartan cult of Artemis Orthia. The details are obscure, but it seems that in classical times, Spartan boys, perhaps as a rite of passage to manhood, had to attempt to steal cheese from the altar of Artemis Orthia while avoiding being whipped. Sparta's military was long since defunct, as we've seen. Can it be then that this ritual was now being performed solely for the purposes of what has been classified by some scholars as sado-tourism in the Roman period? Plutarch, writing at the end of the 1st century AD, casually remarks that he himself saw many boys dying from the lashes they received while doing this. We should also note that the Panhellenic, that's to say, old Greek games like the Olympic Games and so forth, were still going strong in the Roman period. Very likely they too attracted Roman tourists, as I'll discuss in a later lecture. They certainly attracted the Emperor Nero, who, as we shall see later, coveted the title of Olympic victor. In Athens, one of the most spectacular festivals in the Roman period was the Munichia, also incidentally held in honour of Artemis, Munichia being the name of the Acropolis in the port town of Piraeus. The festival, which commemorated the Greek naval victory over the Persians at Salamis in 480 BC, included both a rowing race and a mock sea battle. Now, there seems to be an element here of Greece trading on her quote-unquote glorious past. The Greek world did, however, inject one very important new idea into the Roman world at the time of Augustus, namely ruler cult. As I mentioned in a previous lecture, ruler cult was institutionalized by Alexander's successors, who used it as a way to legitimize their shaky claims to be the founders of new dynasties. And 3 centuries later, it was adopted, albeit very tentatively, by Augustus as a way both to legitimize his rule and to unify the Roman Empire. This wasn't, however, the first time that Romans had been worshipped as gods. Proconsuls, governors, that is, in the eastern provinces, had quite often been accorded divine honours by the Greeks. The first recipient was none other than Titus Quinctius Flamininus, the occasion being his victory over Philip V of Macedon at Kynoscephaly in 197 BC and his declaration of Greek freedom the following year. But what was appropriate for Greece wasn't appropriate for Rome and Italy, so Augustus proceeded with extreme care. One of the reasons why Julius Caesar was assassinated was that he was suspected of coveting divine honours. Given that what we know about Augustus's character, I think it's very likely that he felt a personal reluctance to the institution while recognising that it was a very effective political weapon at a time of constitutional change. I say this because it's evident that he did take steps to promote ruler cult in the western provinces where it had no previous tradition. Ruler cult brings up profound questions about ancient religion. Did anyone really believe that a living emperor was a god in the same way that Jupiter, say, was a god? That's a very hard question to answer. Valerius Paterculus, a pro-establishment Roman historian, describes how an elderly German, a barbarian in other words, and an enemy, when the future emperor Tiberius was in his neighbourhood with a hostile force, could not resist asking permission to gaze upon him and to touch his hand, declaring afterwards rapturously, "I have now seen the god of whom previously I had only heard. It's been the happiest day of my life." Well, we don't need to take this at face value. Valerius is obviously at pains to pay Tiberius a compliment by suggesting that even the stupid and uncouth barbarians recognized his godhead. Even so, we need hardly doubt that there were some individuals who did indeed see the emperor as, well, let's just say, more than mortal. Establishing a cult of the emperor, which in the reign of Augustus was done on a volunteer basis, was a way of showing deference both to Augustus and to Rome, with the expectation that those who honoured the emperor in this way would be in his good books. In other words, ruler cult was a way for leading provincials to catch the emperor's eye. It worked so successfully in the Greek-speaking world, largely because there was already a well-established tradition of commemorating local benefactors. It's easy to dismiss ruler cult as a cynical ploy to elicit and demonstrate favour that has no real religious dimension to it. And in fact, it's one of the most controversial areas of scholarship for historians of ancient religion. One of the foremost defenders of the view that it was both a political and a religious phenomenon is Simon Price, who firmly supports its religious dimension, and he may well be right. We shouldn't forget how grateful people were to Augustus in particular for establishing peace throughout the Roman Empire after two generations of civil bloodshed. An inscription found at Halicarnassus in the province of Asia, dated shortly after the death of Augustus, says, "Whereas the immortal and eternal nature of the universe has bestowed the greatest good upon mankind by producing Caesar Augustus for a happy life for us." And then it breaks off. But we can understand what would have followed, something like, "We, the people of Halicarnassus, are very, very grateful to Augustus." Well, who's to say that their sentiment isn't heartfelt? And who's to say that they didn't think that there was something almost, no, actually divine about Augustus's gifts to them? One other, rather less important question: did the emperors themselves truly believe in their own godhead? I think that's highly unlikely, except perhaps in the case of the Emperor Caligula, who may well have been demented enough to believe he was a god. The final topic I'd like to discuss is that of early Christianity, which clearly has a connection, albeit tangential, with ruler cult. Jesus conducted his ministry in the Roman province of Judea, which was administered by a prefect, a low-ranking official. The prefect at the time was Pontius Pilate, who administered it from AD 26 to 36. I'll have more to say about him later, but it seems clear that he did believe that Jesus represented a serious threat to Rome's rule, though, if the testimony of the gospel writers is to be believed, it was primarily at the instigation of the Jewish authorities that he was crucified. The fact that Judea was a Roman province with what amounted to a strongly nationalistic tradition undoubtedly contributed to the strength of Jesus' appeal. Some of his followers probably interpreted his apocalyptic utterances about the imminent arrival of the kingdom of God as a call to arms and to insurgency. In other words, they probably saw him as a political revolutionary whose mission was to liberate the Jewish people. And though the Gospels themselves scrupulously avoid any suggestion that Jesus had a political agenda, it's not unlikely that many would have been drawn to him in the belief that he did. In which case, the unpopularity of Roman rule in Judea may well have helped to kickstart his mission. What lends some support to this theory is that the Romans usually reserved the punishment of crucifixion for either slaves or for political prisoners. The conversion of the Jesus movement, as it's called in its first generation, into Christianity took place in the Greek-speaking world of the East. But it was the Romans who created the world in which such a development could take place. The most vigorous champion of Christianity in the generation after Jesus' death was Paul, one of the most widely traveled men of antiquity. In the course of his three missionary journeys, Paul visited a number of important Greek cities, including Philippi, Thessalonica, Athens, Corinth, Ephesus, Miletus, Caesarea, and Jerusalem. And the fact that he was able to do this was because the Roman Empire guaranteed freedom of movement, protection, and religious tolerance to all who lived within its borders. Paul subsequently underwent arrest, imprisonment, and trial in both Jerusalem and Caesarea before being transferred to Rome, where he was executed in AD 62 during the reign of Nero. Nero's relationship with the Christians, however, is a subject we'll pick up later. To conclude, the period from 200 BC onwards witnessed a considerable shift in attitude on the part of the Romans towards foreign gods. Suspicion now became a central strand in their dealings with foreign gods, which they now saw as providing a focus for opposition to Roman rule. At the same time, there was no attempt to impose a distinctively Roman religious viewpoint, which, after all, by this point in time, was itself largely eclectic. The one exception is ruler worship, which did become a useful political instrument in focusing devotion upon the emperor. No pagan, the word is actually rather pejorative. It literally means villager and was applied by the early Christians to the polytheists in contempt. No pagan was fired up with a mission to convert the rest of the world to his or her belief system. Everyone was free to make his or her personal selection from the pantheon at large, although in practice, choices would no doubt depend on geographical proximity to a sanctuary, family tradition, professional affiliation, and so on. There was relatively little religious persecution other than when the state felt itself threatened. From the 1st century AD onwards, however, as we shall see later, the Roman state came into headlong collision with both Jews and Christians, in part because they refused to acknowledge the emperor's divinity. Even so, it's fair to say that Rome's most persistent and enduring challenge came from the Greeks. And in the next lecture, we'll be examining how the Greek cities fared under Roman rule, bearing in mind that each of these cities constituted a religious as well as a civic and cultural entity.